more of a seminar today, because apparently most of you couldn't get here after a review. You've met Professor Maxey before. He talked to you about running an architecture office. What he's going to talk to you about today is also a very important concept. It's really, from a developer's standpoint, how a real estate project is financed and run. It's something that you need to understand as an architect so that you can figure out where the money is and can be and where it can't be. Often you're given very frustrating limitations on what can be spent, and there are very good reasons for it. Most of the students who have heard him lecture on this subject before have gone away pretty enlightened by how their clients think of that. And in fact, in terms of bringing in business, one of the best ways to make sure a developer knows that you understand how to design for this kind of project is by being able to talk these kinds of numbers and concepts with him so that he knows you're on the same page. So, John, I'll...
Excuse me, let's start with this, change it. Before we go into developer relation, I want to tell you that an apartment building or any building which is built to earn money is a very difficult and different concept than large number, in fact the majority of the buildings you are going to be hired. Many of the buildings, I don't know, depends on your practice. Many of your buildings will have nothing to do with a developer's investment. Okay? You design a school building. Let's say a building on this campus. All you are asked to do is to work within a budget and make sure that the building stands up and functions properly. Those are the normal building types. Then there are buildings, or for instance a factory, how it ought to function well. Most of those buildings, school buildings, factory buildings, hospital buildings, are built not to earn money, not as an investment, but as a place to fulfill a functional need. The building which primarily is going to be asking you to design it for earning money is an apartment building. And many of you who will go into practice eventually will come across the animal we call the developer, who's going to hire you to do a building which not only stands up, not only functions well, but will earn him money. And you become willy-nilly complicitous in that act, you know? In architecture school, students are never taught this, or mostly are not taught how to work with developers. Developers are unique animals, and animals I mean. You know, it takes a certain mentality to use and risk other people's money. In a little way, like Bernie Madoff. I'm not saying that they are totally, and not all developers. They are some honorable developers. That's an interesting thing that I say they are some, because most of them are not. At least in my practice, I found them very difficult. But believe me, you ought to know something about the game you are becoming part of, because it's a game. It is, you are asked to design a building which not only stands up, not only lasts and can be maintained, not only functions the way they ask you to do that, to do them, but it earns money for the developer and the developer's investments and investors. And that's very difficult, especially if you don't know the game. And that's what we are going to be talking most of first part of the lecture today, about the game. The game, in other words, is called pro forma. Have any of you heard the word pro forma? Pro forma, it's not the physical condition of an athletic pro. Pro forma, no. Nor is it the latest brassiere. Pro forma is called in the trade the economic equation of a development. Let's go through one very simplistic way. Okay, but if we can put up the second slide, that would be great. I'm lazy. Thank you very much for doing. Okay, you have in front of you a pro forma. There are three elements. One is the cost of the building. Then there are the expenses. And then there is the income. Now most developers buy the land, hire an architect, put up a building in order to make money. And the problem comes in that every one of these developments is a gamble. It's a gamble which may take longer to show results. It may never show results, and the investors lose their ass. It's not a business without risks. Former student of mine, very recently, very good architect, married another architect. And about 4 years ago, when things were going well, bought a piece of property in the South Loop, where last year there were 4,000 vacant units in the South Loop area. They figured they will be all putting up a building and they'll make some money. They got to the first floor, and they ran out of money, the loan was called, they lost the property. Let's see what the loan is, what the game is. Okay, the first item is the cost of the project, which includes no magic to it, most of you know it, but let's go through. Includes the cost of the land, all the utility extensions to the land, if they are not there already, the construction cost of the building, the one which you're supposed to be in control of, the furnishings, the architects and engineers fee, legal expenses, accounting expenses, miscellaneous items such as soil borings, surveys, marketing. Marketing is very costly. Sometimes it takes longer, it's unpredictable. These are the costs of the project in the entity. But you also have to pay interest on the construction loan. So at that, the cost of the project and the interest of the money, on the money you borrow, is the total cost. Yeah.
Let me interrupt if I can here for a moment, sorry to do this, and fill you in on the financing of a real estate project like this, because there's some elements you need to know and understand, especially about the loans John was talking about. After the developer buys the property, and usually they do that with their own funds or their investors' funds, it's usually a direct equity where they have direct ownership of that. Then they have to finance the construction. They almost never have enough money raised to finance the construction. They don't want to do it that way. The way that they finance the construction is by taking out a specialized kind of bank loan called a construction loan. And what's unique about it is that it's almost like a revolving line of credit that you would have on your credit card, where if you end up borrowing money from your credit card company by not paying everything back at the end of the month, you're charged interest on whatever the outstanding debt is at that time. Well, a construction loan works like that too. Let's just use round numbers. Say it was $1 million construction cost. Well, the developer wouldn't need to pay $1 million in the first month of construction. The cost initially would be fairly low. So instead of the bank giving him $1 million to pay for the construction, the bank opens up a line of credit for him worth $1 million. So at the end of the first month, when they've just done site clearance and excavation, maybe only $100,000 of costs are incurred. So he takes the contractor's invoices at the end of that first month to the bank, and the bank advances $100,000 against that line of credit to pay the contractors. And the next month, more construction work is done, and he takes those invoices to the bank, and the bank advances more and more money up until $1 million is used up, because that was the total construction cost that we were assuming for, you know, purposes of what I'm saying right here. It works to the developer's advantage, because initially, he's not paying interest on the whole $1 million. The first month, he's just paying interest on $100,000. The second month, it's just on a couple $100,000 or so. So he doesn't have big interest payments until near the end of the job, when almost the whole loan has been pulled, and then he's paying interest on almost the whole loan. And by the end of the job, it is the whole loan. So it works out better from that standpoint. From the bank's standpoint, it's safer, because they haven't invested, the project isn't worth anything to them until it's finished. I mean, if you have a half-finished building, it's useless. No one's going to want the land or be able to do anything that makes money with it. So if the bank were to foreclose and take it over in the middle of the project, they'd have something that's kind of useless to them. So they don't want to invest the whole loan into the project until it's in a state when they can actually use it. So it works better for them from a security standpoint to be investing gradually, too. And in fact, developers are so crooked sometimes, obviously not all of them, but there are plenty, that if they gave the developer $1 million for a construction loan right up front, all $1 million, the developer would be in Aruba the next month, enjoying $1 million, and the project would never get going. At least that may happen. And it would be bad lending practices by the banks, so they really can't afford to do that. Now, because a construction loan is risky, that because the collateral for the loan is uncertain. I mean, the building's not built yet. So if the bank were to take it over, it's kind of useless to them. They'd have to go and finish it, which means they have to run the development project. So it's not as good a collateral as if they'd made a loan against an already completed building. Because the risk factor to the bank is higher, the interest rate to the developer is higher. So a construction loan is a higher interest loan than what you'd take if you were just getting a loan to buy a condo or a building or something like that, because the collateral for your finished building is complete.
If you default on the loan, the bank takes over the building, and they can sell it to whoever on the open market. But no one's going to buy a half-completed building. So developers use construction loans because it's in their to their advantage, paying less interest, even though the interest rate is a little bit higher. But as soon as the project is over, they no longer want to be paying the higher interest rate on a construction loan rather than a lower interest rate on what's called a normal mortgage loan. So as soon as the project is done and able to be occupied, they do what's called, they take a second loan out to pay off the first loan. It's called an end loan, or sometimes a takeout loan. But it's a mortgage loan for a finished building now, rather than a construction loan. So given our example of a $1 million construction loan, the building was just completed, the developer's just drawn the last of the $1 million to pay the contractors, and now the developer goes back to the same bank, or possibly a different bank, but it's usually the same bank, and takes out a new mortgage loan for the $1 million, and the proceeds of that he uses to pay off the old loan. It's basically substituting a cheaper, lower interest loan for the older, higher interest construction loan. Because now that the collateral is complete, the building is finished, it's a safer loan for the bank again. So he can get the cheaper loan. So he's paying off interest in two different segments. During construction, he's paying the higher interest rate, but drawing it down gradually. After construction is complete and the end loan is taken off out to pay off the construction loan, then he's paying a normal mortgage loan the same way you would on your house or condo if you owned one, just the normal percentage that a bank would charge with a mortgage against the property. So those are the interest costs. The cost of doing the project is the interest on the construction loan. As Professor Maxey will tell you, there is a cost on the mortgage loan for maintaining the project, which falls under the expense side rather than under the cost side, because it's one of the costs of owning or running a building.
Okay. We talked about the cost of the construction. There are also tremendous expenses during construction and after. What are they? They are all the utilities, gas, oil, water, electricity, operating personnel, engineer, doorman, driver, whatever. There is constant repair and maintenance on every building. There is a management office, usually. There is a continued marketing effort. There is no such thing as you don't have vacancies. And there is insurance. There are real estate taxes. Variety of miscellaneous expenses. These are called operating costs or operating expenses. Plus the retirement of the mortgage are called the total expense. There is also income. As you see, that's a very short column because it's very simple. There are the apartment rents. If there is any commercial or office space in the building, the lease is on that. Maybe there is additional income from renting the garage spaces. You take the totality of these incomes, that's called the gross income, from which you have to deduct the vacancies. Always, always there are some vacancies. You'll see later in the latter part of this lecture that the Chicago area is figured for 7%. If you take the cost, let's say take the gross income, deduct the vacancies as your net income or your cash flow. And that's that total equation. Okay? Profit, if there is a profit, usually is expressed as a percentage of the equity you have in the building. You know, in the Chicago area, in good times, not today, good times, say 8 years ago, used to be that a reasonably intelligently designed apartment building, in every 8 to 10 years, you doubled your investment. And I can personally vouchsafe this because I think that you give an example. I have a house in Bridgman, Michigan. It's on the dunes. It's a highly desirable location. And I bought a piece of, little piece of property in 1970 for $4,000. I designed a little house, no working doing, just plans and elevations. Detailing I left for the contractor. It was so simple. And told him it cannot be more than $15,000. Well, it was 16 plus 4 for the land. That was an investment of $20,000 in 1970. 9 years later, another subdivision opened. There was a chance to pick a bigger piece of property closer to the lake. So I put this up for sale and I sold it for $45,000. Not so bad on a $20,000 investment. I built a new house immediately for $50,000, 3 bedrooms. The new piece of property was 9, so it was $58,000. In a few years later, that was in 1980, okay? In 88, I added another floor. I planned for it for $16,000. So my total investment was $74,000 in 1988. Just for the, I still have it. In 98, just for the hell of it, I called an appraiser to give me an appraisal of the value. That was 10 years later. It was appraised at $160,000. $7,400. It's not mathematically accurate, but roughly doubled its value. And today, I am told, it's worth over $300,000, which is again doubling the value. Is it true everywhere? I am sure not. This is a highly desirable location. You could sell, even in the worst times, you could sell that property because there aren't any more left. Michigan Dunes is a limited commodity. So if there is one opening, there are obvious clients. Very simply, this is one side of real estate investment. The other is my former student who thought, you know, going is good and the South Loop is doing nothing but growing. And they lost their shirt. I mean, I'm desperately sorry for her. They had to borrow themselves. I mean, land made all kinds of deals with the lender. But anyhow, eventually they got out of their difficulties. The simple lesson of today's lecture, and especially the second half, is that you have to know enough of this business to talk the language of the developer. You cannot be the typical architectural designer who's only interested in design. You know, move into your attic, turn on some good records, and spend the time playing with the pencil and pen or whatever, or computer. You have to understand it's a game, and you are part of the game, and the more and earlier you understand the game, the more respect you will gain from your clients.
Let me fill you in on the goal of the game, because John has that down at the bottom of the slide here. Obviously, you think of it as the goal to make a profit, but that's one step short of the actual goal. As Professor Maxey said, business people tend to express their profit as a percentage of equity. A more common term that you may have heard to describe this is called return on investment. It's used all the time. The MBA types even use it by the acronym ROI, return on investment. And it means that it's important not only to have a great deal of profit, but to have it on as small an original investment as possible. This is kind of a formula that will get fixed by real estate necessities. The element that's not in this formula of income minus expense equals profit is growth. That's what Professor Maxey has been talking about with the real estate that he had purchased doubling in value over 8 to 10 years. If the developer can minimize his initial out-of-pocket investment and make the money up from other investors, or better yet, from borrowing, that means that all of the growth is to his account. So, for example, if the developer invested $100,000 into a $1 million project, and the project doubled eventually in value to $2 million, his $100,000 would have resulted in a growth portion of the profit of $1 million, 10 times its amount. But imagine if he had only put in $50,000 instead of the $100,000. He would still have realized $1 million of growth, but the denominator of the equation would be half as big. So the total percentage that his $50,000 would have grown would be twice as big as if it were $100,000. Instead of growing 10 times, it would have grown 20 times, which is why they try to make more money as a higher percentage of their initial investment. So the key to analyzing a real estate deal, and this is what your developer clients will already know, is what kind of return on investment it promises. And that's because the world is a marketplace. If you had $50,000 to invest, you might invest it in a real estate deal. But you have an alternative. You could put it into the stock market. You could buy bonds with it. You could buy gold or something like that and hope that it grows. There are a lot of different investment choices that the developer or any of his investors can make with their money. What they look for is the best return on that investment, which is measured against the amount that they've invested. So the less they have to put in to realize their percentage share of the growth, the better the return on that particular investment is. Now, the next portion of Professor Maxey's presentation is going to be a much more detailed arithmetical financial analysis of what goes on in a multifamily residential building. You're not going to be expected to do the math. Don't worry about that. The actual numbers that go up here aren't as important as understanding the concepts that they represent. So you will need to understand the theory behind all of this, but you don't need to be able to reproduce the mathematics. So don't worry about that, and I'll put the next slide up.
Okay. Well, should we take a short break? I'm going to take a 10-minute break.
Okay. Professor Max, I suggest that we take a 10-minute break and come back at 10:40.
Okay.
Okay? See you then. Can I get that, and I'll turn it off?
It's in my pocket.
You can stand up and... Thank you.
Okay.
No.
Very good. Okay, if I may get your attention, you know, some of you might think that it's better under a non-capitalist system. I can tell you, I would think so too, but the problem is I lived under that system in Hungary, and the communist system doesn't work at all. Take, for instance, an apartment building. The government does not have enough money to properly maintain it, so nobody maintains it. Nobody feels they have an ownership in it. So, for instance, this really happened. Many of the smaller apartment buildings, which were not economical as an investment for the government as an investor, they privatized it. They turned it over to the tenants. It was a nice thing to do, and it was good for the, each one bought his very reasonably, his apartment or her apartment, and these smaller buildings, most of them were 8-unit buildings. The minute the last unit sold to a private party, it was like the apartment building took a deep breath, because the first thing you could see, they repainted the stair hall. I mean, the metamorphosis was remarkable. They painted the exterior, and within months, the building was totally rejuvenated. Why? Because it was theirs. And you protect your investment, and when it belongs to the state, a state who does not maintain it, you, to be very vulgar, don't give a shit. That's very simple. Anyhow, let's talk about the economic equation. And as Mark told you, the numbers are not important, or the accuracy of the number. Let's take a building. How does the economic equation work? Assume a 12 to 14 story apartment building, somewhere in a good location. I live in Evanston, so I assume it's in Evanston. 100 units each, 2 bedrooms, each 1,200 square feet, covered with 100 parking spaces and 5,000 square foot of small commercial. What are the components? There is the land. Say the land is about $25,000 per unit, not an unreasonable figure. You will hear the land expressed as the value per unit. 25,000 is reasonable, 100 unit building, so it's 2,000,005. The building, it's very interesting, by the way, this first page number game, you don't even have to design the building. You design it by numbers. You don't really ultimately do, but you can grasp it. You have 100 units at 1,200 square feet. That's 120,000 square feet. That's the net unit. you have to add to that corridor, exterior wall, stairways, elevator shaft, corridor supply shaft, all the non-habitable square footage. It's about 20%. That's 24,000. We are asking for common areas, give or take 10,000 square feet, commercial 5,000, total is 159,000 square feet, times $120 a square foot construction cost. At least that was a few years ago. I really honestly don't even know what it's today, because there are no apartment buildings going up. But I assume that we are a few years back, $120 a square feet times 159,000 is $19 million. Add the garage at 350 square foot per automobile, that includes the driving space, that's 35,000 square feet. At $70 a square foot, that's about $2.5 million. The hard cost is $24 million. Now, if you can do that, you don't need an architect. You don't need plans. But in a way, there's great truth in it. When I was in practice, I did that on every building as soon as we got the program. You're in fact designing the building by the numbers. It's very simple. Number of units, square feet, add to it because that represents net, not gross. And you can come up with a reasonable number, which should not be more than 10-15% off. This is your control. You can do it to keep yourself in line. Because if you design this building with units which are bigger than the client program, or the CAR, we used to call it, the square footage, which is not rental, which is the walls, the corridors, etc., more than 20%, you are doing something wrong. So it's a very good control over your own designer's instincts, which is to do everything better, overdo it, and not build it. But self-discipline in architecture is extremely important. I mean, it's a very simple calculation. I was in a jury of one of the design classes. The name will be absolutely unimportant. The last time I was in a jury, and the person put up the floor plan, and I said, this building is not buildable. And she looked at me astounded. How do you know? I said, because your stairs, elevators, corridor occupies far larger space than your units. And it's that simple. You are on the wrong way. You are on the wrong road if you don't keep the non-money producing square footage in line. It's very easy to get out of the line. It's very easy to dream and have luxurious corridors and all kinds of bends and turns and superfluous space in the stairway. If it doesn't work, the number, that 20%, you're screwed. It's that simple. Anyhow, besides the construction costs, which we just finished talking about, you also have what we call soft costs. Loan repayment, lender's fee. You know, lenders are real animals. Besides getting a percentage, there is a fee for the privilege of lending you money. There is an architect's fee, say 4%. It's a very, very low fee. Shouldn't ever be 4% on an apartment building, because you're going to lose money. An apartment building you cannot do well. Total service under 5%, that's minimum. Then there is legal fee, marketing fee, miscellaneous. That's the total soft cost, okay? The total cost is the sum of the soft and hard costs, and the total cost in this case is over $26 million. Now comes the income. We had apartments, say 1,600 a month, 100 units, 4 months, 1,000,009. Garage rentals, commercial, deduct 5% vacancy. We always deduct vacancy, whether there is or not. Safety factor, not a major factor. Total income is 2,000,153. What are the expenses? In the Chicago area, management expenses, salaries, utilities, maintenance, real estate taxes, which is a big one, is about 40% of the income, as a general rule. Would be nice to have less, but for our calculation, we accept that income. And there is mortgage retirement. The total expense with management and mortgage retirement, here it's $2,000,002. The income was $2,150,000. We are losing money. Okay? That is not a good deal. What?
Depending on how the real estate market is doing, the investors are losing 1.4% of their investment every year. But if the building is going up in value 10% a year, then it's still a positive kind of investment. In today's marketplace, you wouldn't get any kind of appreciation. But historically, 10% a year was not at all out of line.
No, absolutely. Let's say if it can be improved by charging more rent. And that's the next slide. We look at the income, increase the apartment rent to $2,000 a month. Let's assume it's doable. The garage is there. Commercial is there. Subtotal $2,740,000, less vacancy. The total income is $2,006,000. That's a little better. The expenses are the same. The balance is about $220,000, which is on your net investment, on your equity in the deal, it's a 5.6% return.
Let me just point out this line, which probably is somewhat confusing, mortgage retirement. You notice that it's 6% interest rate on the mortgage loan. Compare that to the 7% that Professor Maxey was estimating for the construction loan. So this mortgage loan is the end loan that I was talking about at the lower interest rate. Now, why would you pay 85%? And anybody ever bought a house or a condo? Will the bank ever loan you 100% of the purchase price?
No.
They make you put your own down payment on it first, and then they make up the balance. So here, for this kind of commercial property, the bank is assuming that the developer is going to be contributing 15% of the $26 million out of his own money and his own investors. And the mortgage is going to be the loan making up the remaining 85% of it. So the only interest that has to be paid is on what's actually been loaned, not on the entire $26 million. So the interest is going to be 6% of the 85%, which works out to John's $1.3 million here.
Okay. Let's now look into another way of doing it, remembering the story I told you in Hungary when the apartments were privatized and how everything turned rosy. Let's see what happens if we kind of privatize this and design condominiums. The architectural service is really the same. The building is identical. It's how it's going to be marketed. The hard cost is identical. The soft cost is the same with some increases, which are logical. You need a broker to sell the units. You need some additional legal service. And you need what they call a three-dimensional survey, not the land, but the building. Somehow or other, there need to be a legal description of the unit which you own, from the corridor wall to including the exterior wall. You cannot describe that. You need a surveyor. And you add all that together, you're talking about $28 million. And you want to make, when you sell those units, say 15%. That's a reasonable profit, $4 million. The total is $32 million. And you're selling 100 units. Divide 32 million by 100, that's $320,000 for a one-bedroom apartment. In Evanston, where I live, I know the market, that's a reasonable expectation to get on a good one-bedroom unit, $320,000 today. So when it's condominium, when it's sold, and it becomes the property of the buyer and not just a rental unit, the entire picture changes. And that was one reason so many buildings turned into condos. The interesting thing is now it's getting, it's a reverse.
Exactly.
And I don't understand why it's that reverse.
Give me the microphone and I'll explain.
Good.
You want to take it out of your pocket? No. Thank you. Professor Maxey raises a very good question. If you followed the marketplace, you'll know that 10 to 20 years ago, condominiums were booming all over the place. All the new residential projects were condos. And now, anyone seen a condo building go up in the last 2 to 3 years? Not at all. Everything now is rental. And the reason, no, leave that on. The reason is right in these numbers. The bottom one, the $320,000 per apartment number. The flux between the leasing market and the condo market is a function of the real estate marketplace. When housing is hot, when more people are chasing housing than there are actual housing units available, the prices are going to go up. That happens a lot. I mean, why you would normally think the same number of people, more or less, in the country, why would sometimes housing be hot and other times not? And it's really not our country that's doing it. It's investment from abroad. There was, for a long time, the Japanese invested very heavily in the U.S. real estate market. They would buy up huge numbers of condominiums and rent them out. And why would they bother to do that? Because the rental really just paid for the costs. Because the U.S. real estate market had a history of going up and up 10% a year or so, as John was explaining with his Michigan beach house. So they thought it was a great investment. Real estate goes up 10% a year. How many investments do that? And they were right for a while until that bubble burst and everything collapsed a few years ago. But in that hot market, when real estate is going up and up, you have a lot of people interested in buying places and participating in that growth. So the prices go up. And when the prices are high enough that you can get $320,000 for an apartment, for a condominium of this type in Evanston, then it makes all the sense in the world to do this project as a condo project. Because you can see the developer is making 15% profit here when he sells the units, assuming that he's able to sell them. And that's way more than the percentage profits we were talking about. You know, we were talking about 1% or 2% profit or even a loss when it was being run as a rental building. So there's way more profit in it for the developer if he can sell the condos for $320,000. But today, in Evanston, that same condo that John had priced at $320,000 might be $250,000 because it's gone down in value with the real estate reversal. And if you multiply 250,000 times the 100 units, you don't get nearly enough money to make a profit. It's better, you're better off doing it as a rental. In fact, buildings 3 years ago that were going up as condos converted back to being rental units when the condo market collapsed because the equation showed that the developer could either make more as a rental than a condo or else at least lose less. Because nothing is worse than the developer holding out for $320,000 and not selling and sitting there paying the mortgage cost and the maintenance for this building where people aren't buying the condos. That's the biggest disaster of all. So it's the real estate return on investment that determines whether the project will be done as a condo or as a rental building. Now, let me tell you a little bit about condos, because you have huge legal issues that involve architects when you're dealing with condominium projects. It's because the developer who builds them or develops them is not the same entity as the people who are going to be living in them. And that leads to all kinds of bad incentives. John has probably fought this during a lot of his architectural career. The natural tendency of a developer is to, the nice word is value engineer, but the truth of it is to cheapen the details that you want to put into your condominium buildings, especially on stuff that doesn't affect actual function of the of the units. So the developer has a mixed feeling where in some point he's trying to sell the units by offering your design. I mean, because your design is supposed to be appealing to the unit owners. But at the same time, he's trying to cut out everything that's expensive in your design because that's cutting directly into his profit margin. It's a cost, which he's hoping to avoid. Where things get tricky and where the lawyers get involved is when the developer goes a step further. And the developer cuts things that are important for unit function. He hires some cheap mason who isn't going to bother to flash the walls correctly. And as a result, water penetrates. Or goes with an HVAC system that's really a little underpowered or has ridiculous life cycle consequences for the building because the hard initial costs are lower. The developer's goal is to sell the units as quickly as possible and cash out, turn the building over to the condominium association, and then vacation in Aruba for the rest of his life. So he will have nothing to do with the building, and the new owners, the condo association and the unit owners, are going to have to cope with the developer's long-term decisions about where to cut money. And when he cuts money in a way that hurts function, with water penetration, ridiculous HVAC, operating expenses, things like that, the condo association gets sold a bill of goods. Do you think he tells them that this condominium building was built with the cheapest mason who's quite likely to have blown the flashing details, so you can expect a high likelihood of water penetration? Not exactly salesworthy. So they don't say that. They talk about the HVAC system, but they neglect to mention that it was chosen because its initial costs were cheap and its life cycle operating costs are expensive. A whole bunch of laws have built up around the state laws and even local laws to try to force developers to be honest in their description of condo buyers about how the units will function. Because if you go in and are being shown a condo, it's a real estate agent who's going to be showing it to you. They're going to try to sell as hard as they can. And odds are, they don't know how the building's been cheapened. They aren't technically expert. They weren't there to see the flashing being omitted. And they have no idea that they're selling you a bill of goods. So the developer often is forced to make warranties or guarantees to purchase the unit owners and to the condominium association. So if they turn out to be false, a guarantee such as, the walls were built with the normal, reasonable standards. And if they weren't, then the condo association has the right to sue the developer for breach of the warranty to be made whole the cost of fixing the walls. Now, developers are a step ahead because developers don't do business as individuals. Remember how we learned about different ways of doing business, partnerships, corporations, LLCs? Well, developers know that too. Developers do business either as corporations or as LLCs because of the liability protection that they afford. So when the condominium association figures out that the problems are endemic to the building, inherent in the building, and three years after they have taken ownership and seen what the leaks are, then they sue the developer, and by that time, all the money has been taken out of the corporation or the LLC, and it's a judgment-proof company. There's nobody left to, no assets left to pay any losses. So the condo association and unit owners are out, cold, nothing they can do. What happens is that they then will make a claim against anybody else who might have a deep pocket to pay these losses. Either directly or indirectly, they'll make a claim against the architect, the contractor. If they can make claims against the masonry subcontractor, they will. Even against the manufacturer of the HVAC system, claiming that it's defective or substandard or something like that. Many of these claims are not successful because it was the developer who set the criteria and everybody else just supplied what the developer asked for. But the condo associations are desperate. It's more than that. And here's where the lawyers are to blame. Lawyers have developed specialty in representing condo associations, and they figured out a way to foment litigation that wouldn't otherwise happen. Here's what the sneaky lawyers do. They get a reputation for being a condo expert, and the condominium board asks them to come to a meeting and to let them know what their options are to get rid of, to raise the money to fix all these leaks. And the condo board, the lawyer, turns to the people on the condo board who are elected and says, you really don't have a choice here. You have fiduciary duties. Remember that we talked about in terms of agency? Well, the condo board members are agents or fiduciaries for the unit owners. They're acting in their stead on their behalf. So the lawyer terrifies them by saying, as a fiduciary, you have a legal obligation to use your best efforts to help the unit owners. If you turn a blind eye and don't file this lawsuit, the unit owners could sue you as board members for not watching out for their interests properly. And he scares them into thinking they have no choice but to hire this lawyer to file the lawsuit. And the lawsuit may or may not have a good chance of success. That depends on a lot of different factors. But the lawyers, meanwhile, have started this whole litigation ball rolling and are being paid on an hourly basis to chase architects, contractors, developers, and others to try to raise some money to pay for these repairs. Sometimes good things happen, and the money gets raised, or some of it does, and the condo association raises the rest with special assessments. We actually did that once. Last year, there was a condominium association in Lake Bluff, Illinois, a far northern suburb, And the condo building was done design-build. We'll talk about that in 3 weeks or so, where the same entity both designed and constructed it as the general contractor, because they had architects in-house as well as construction capacity. The developer, like most developers, had hired them to do it and had now kind of gone out of business. And the condo association came to me and asked what they could possibly do. And I first told them, you got to hire an architect or engineer to survey what's wrong and figure out why the roof is leaking so terribly. That was the nature of the problem. And a qualified forensic engineer, it was called, examined the building carefully and found out that the roof was very poorly designed, not the inadequate ventilation, didn't even comply with code, and had some construction problems as well. And that was clearly the primary cause of the roof leaks. So now it was clear that the condo association had to either fix the roof or else live with the leaks. And they were going to fix the roof, but came to me to see if there was any way they could get somebody to pay for part of it. So we found out the developer was out of business, and we went to him and said, instead of suing you, what we want to do is to arrange to step into your shoes. We know you don't have any money left in your entity, so we're not going to bother to sue you. We'll promise not to. But we want you to assign to us your rights against the design build company that designed and constructed the building, including the roof. So he was happy to do that to avoid being in a lawsuit. So we kind of stepped into his shoes. And now, in the shoes of the developer, we had a contract directly with this design build company. Because, as we're going to talk about later in the class, not this class, but in a few weeks, for these kinds of problems, you can only sue somebody that you have a contract with. So we had to get contractual rights against this design build company. And now once we stood in the developer's shoes, we filed a lawsuit against the design build company for negligent design and construction of the roof, breaching their contract by not designing it according to code and in accordance with normal standards of care. And we went to a mediation. Remember mediation? That's the non-binding negotiation with a third-party neutral assisting. And in this case, we had a retired judge who understood construction and who explained to the design builder that based on these facts, we were probably going to win. And they were lucky that although the repair cost was in the range of $1 million, we'd be willing to settle for about $700,000 ultimately. We ended up getting $710,000 out of our $1 million costs, which was huge. I mean, that saved 3/4 of the repair costs for each of the unit owners that they would otherwise have had to spend out of pocket, and that would have been a lot. So we struck a deal without having to go to really expensive litigation, where the architect, through its professional liability insurance policy, which is another concept we'll be talking about in a few weeks, ended up anteing up 3/4 of the money to pay for all the roof repairs. But it's typical that condominium association litigation is probably the single biggest element of construction litigation in the country. In Illinois, it's not so bad, or it's not horrible. Where it's really lousy is in the Sun Belt. Anyone want to hazard a guess why condo litigation is twice as bad in the Sun Belt as it is here in Illinois? Well, that's because there are so many retirement communities. You know, some people retire in Illinois, but it's more common for somebody to move down to Florida, sell their place here, and buy a condo on the beach or something like that and live out the rest of their days there. So live out the rest of their days, that's the cause of the problem. They're bored. These are intelligent, educated people who were used to be employed full-time, and now they're retired. They're outside their normal social milieu, and they have a lot of time on their hands. Yeah. Professor Max, I just took a month in Sanibel, just rented a place in Florida, and was on the car ride here, he was telling me that one of the major feelings was being kind of at loose ends, somewhat bored, having time on his hands. And these smart people who see these problems, like leaky walls or roof, with time on their hands, take it upon themselves to agitate for a solution, and rather than the lawyers having to drum up all the business, a lot of these retired people are former lawyers or former architects or people who know that it shouldn't be happening this way, and they go to the lawyers and get these cases started. So there's a huge industry in condominium litigation, especially in Florida, but Arizona, California, all kinds of places that are typical retirement communities. So that's the other risk of the condominium marketplace from an architect's point of view. John, is there anything that you'd like to add?
No, I kind of to bring some of this back to the perspective of where you guys are going to sit. And of course, Mark and I would never be those sneaky lawyers that he was talking about. But the reason why we're talking about the financial situation, the financial of these models and everything up here, is to teach you that you're going to have to be able to speak a certain language with the developer. And if you remember from our review of the B101, a reoccurring obligation that you owe under that contract is to do a cost estimate of how much that project will cost. And so you will have a duty to figure out those costs of what your designs are. So when you're designing, you need to think about those things. And while most of our examples today are centering around the condo development, when you think about your various types of projects, the developer, while they are interested in the design, it's secondary to how they think about it because their business is selling. And so when you have a developer of a condo, he thinks of the design in a per unit cost. When you have a development of a hotel, they think of the hotel as a per key cost. When you have someone that develops single family homes, they look at it as per unit or sometimes on a per square footage. So when you are looking at pricing, and you go in, as Professor Max I was talking about, and me being a former designer myself, while we want to make these wonderful, lovely lobby spaces and have some really interesting elements that go on in the secondary rooms for workout rooms or whatever else is going to be in the building, the developer thinking per unit for my condo, per key for my hotel, is thinking about that in dollars and cents. And all of those spaces that we, as the designers, will think are much more attractive and will sell the building, actually take away or increase that per unit or per key cost that the developer's looking at. So you're always going to be in this push-pull. When you're developing per the B101, your cost estimates, the cost of the work, you may ask to be presented it as the total project cost, and he may ask you to break it down. Well, what's that by per key? What's that my per unit? What's that my per square footage cost? Tell me what those are going to be. So he goes back and crunches the numbers. And that's where you, as the architect, have to learn to balance. And what your design skills, your first love is to design. And the secondary or even tertiary thing is, oh my God, I got to figure out how much this costs. And that rolls in what Mark was talking about, value engineering and some of these other things. When you come back and you say, your per unit cost, Mr. Condo Developer, is $320. He says, I can't make a profit on that. I need you to value engineer down to $300 per unit. And that means you, Mr. Architect, have to start slashing things. And that's where you get into this, depending on how far the developer pushes you, where you start getting yourself into a position of exposure or liability. If you cut out too many things that are necessary, as Mark was talking about, for the function of the building, and later down the road, we get these condo owners, and they say, I have a leaky building, or my faucets don't work properly. They're going to come after the developer and you to try to figure out who is at fault and why there's that problem. So it's a balance, and you need to think when you're talking to that developer, am I looking at it per unit, per key, square footage, you know, those types of things, all the way from a single-family home all the way up to, for Mark, I'm not sure what they talked about in the development of the hotel, or the hospital. That may have been just an overall budget. But there's all these different ways you have to think of the language of your client that has nothing almost to do with the designs you're doing.